Well, hello, everyone. If you subscribe to our New Denver Church Message podcast and just listen to messages regularly, this is one of those supplemental podcasts that we do every now and then where there's some material or there's some discussion or explanation that I feel like it would be important to talk about, but it didn't fit into a regular message. It's maybe supplemental to something we already talked about. And so we are in this series on the topic of sin and trying to understand what sin is, and particularly some of the things Paul said about sin in the book of Romans. And so we started with sin as disobedience. We looked at that, and then sin as idolatry. And then in this most previous message, I introduced the idea of sin as wounding. And we covered a lot of ground and talked about a whole bunch of different stuff. And so there are a number of extra things that I think could be helpful to talk about. But obviously the two disclaimers I would make before you even keep listening to this podcast is, first, if you didn't listen to the previous message, you need to go back and listen to that, because I'm just going to build on or add to some things we discussed there. So none of this will make sense if you didn't listen to the previous message about original sin and wounding. And then second, I don't really have a script in front of me. I haven't written out a well-formed outline. I have a few ideas jotted down that have been kicking around in my head, or things that I thought about including in the previous message but didn't fit for some reason. But I'm not following any sort of ordered script. This is more shooting from the hip, offering some thoughts for you to consider. So just take it in that way. So let's jump in. The main argument that Paul makes in this one verse, Romans 5:12, which launches a whole section in this letter of Romans, but we focused on this one verse because he begins this argument and he makes a link between the sin and consequences that we experience today and Adam's original sin and Adam's original consequences, which Paul said was death. Augustine came along, as we said in the last message, and he connected those dots that Paul makes. Paul alludes to a bunch of connections between Adam's sin and our sin, but Augustine came up with what is called the doctrine of original sin, where he said Adam's sin and the consequences that came from that led to the inheritance for all of us of a sinful nature, that we have inherited Adam's sinful nature. So we are not born neutral, as Pelagius suggested. We are born into sin. Now, let me be super clear here. I questioned some things about that, and I questioned less Augustine's original thoughts and more some of the things that were added onto original sin and Augustine's thoughts and what it built up and became and what we have now inherited. And so I'll get into that more in a second, but I just want to be clear. I'm not suggesting that we should go back to Pelagius. I said that, but I want to say it again because... here's why. Pelagius, if you are familiar with Christian theology at all, or you have studied this in depth, Pelagius has become this token symbol of someone who did not take sin seriously, and he was labeled a heretic because he basically said, we're all born neutral. We have the chance or choice at any moment to choose to sin or to not sin. And Augustine's view won out. Pelagius was labeled a heretic. And over the last 1,500 years, anytime anyone has come along and questioned the seriousness of sin, has raised any questions that humans are actually and really sinful, they are accused of being Pelagian. That is literally an adjective that is used. And in some Christian circles, to be accused of Pelagianism is anathema. Like, it is heresy. And so anyone who uses the example of Pelagius or sort of talks about sin in the way Pelagius did is accused of this horrible heresy, right? So I just want to be clear, I'm not suggesting Pelagius was right about sin, but I do think he gets a bad rap. If you go back and look at this debate between Pelagius and Augustine, they really are a couple of guys trying to figure out what Paul is saying and what Paul meant. And they're some of the first ones in Christian history, the first couple of hundred years of Christian, of the church. Theologians were concerned with other topics and debates. And Pelagius and Augustine are really the first who are wrestling with the nature of sin and what we inherited. And Pelagius can often get a bad rap. Nothing Pelagius believed about God or sin or humanity or the gospel contradicts the Apostles' Creed. Nothing Pelagius believed contradicted what became known later as the Nicene Creed. So in every other way, from what we can understand, Pelagius was a follower of Jesus. He believed in who Jesus was. He believed in what Jesus did on the cross. He believed in the resurrection. He believed in the Trinity, all of these things. He just came to the conclusion he did not think we inherited a sinful nature. And that has never been a central topic of the Christian faith. Some have come along and made it a central topic, but it was not part of any of the original creeds of Christianity. And so sometimes Pelagius gets a bad rap, even though nothing he believed really contradicted any of the central tenets of the Christian faith at the time. So just wanted to start with that. As I said in the message, Augustine came up with this doctrine of original sin, which basically meant Adam's original sin changed all of humanity afterward. And every human that has come after Adam has inherited this fundamental sinful nature. And then after Augustine, many other doctrines of the Christian faith were built upon this idea of original sin. And I mentioned in the message, Roman Catholic theology became obsessed with this idea of original sin for the next 1,000 years. And let me just give you a few examples or implications of how certain doctrines within the Catholic Church were built up and based upon this doctrine of original sin. So, for example, as it relates to sex, the transmission of our original sinful nature was linked to sex. Because when two people have sex and they have a child, they are passing on, in the way Augustine thought about it, they are passing on the sinful nature through this act of reproduction. It is genetically passed on through the descendants of Adam. So this actually began to make sex itself feel somehow tainted. It's dirty. It is the carrier of the sinful nature. This also made celibacy become more significant and important in the church throughout the Middle Ages. This was the time when the Catholic Church eventually required all priests, all leaders of the church, to be celibate. Now, there's other reasons they required this. They believed that Paul and Jesus both modeled celibacy, and as far as we know, they did. And Paul in 1 Corinthians 7 describes how celibacy is important because it allows someone to focus only on ministry and their relationship with God and not have to also focus on a relationship with a spouse and with a family. So there's other things that went into this lifting up of celibacy, but certainly views of sex and original sin contributed to this idea that sex is somehow tainted, it's the carrier of sin, and the most holy, the most righteous, the leaders of the church should be people who refrain from and are and committed to a life of celibacy and refraining from sex. and therefore passing on the sinful nature. Another area that this idea of original sin impacted theology and doctrine is for Jesus and Mary. Because then it was speculated, maybe this is why Jesus never sinned. Because he did not have a sinful nature. That became a big debate as well. Did Jesus have a sinful nature or not? Maybe he did not have a sinful nature, and this explains why he never sinned. And maybe he didn't have a sinful nature because he didn't have a human father. He wasn't conceived in the natural way. If we believe in the virgin birth, if we believe that Mary was conceived by the Holy Spirit, this explains why Jesus didn't have a sinful nature. He never inherited it. Now, then that raises questions of, well, is the sinful nature only inherited through the man? Literally and biologically speaking, through sperm? What about Mary's sinful nature? If the sinful nature is contributed to by both the father and the mother, the sperm and the egg, why, you know, we know Joseph's spiritual or sinful nature wasn't passed on to Jesus because he wasn't that biological father, but what about Mary's sinful nature? Why wasn't it passed on to Jesus? And this is when the idea came forward. Maybe Mary was miraculously sinless too. Maybe Mary never committed a sin. Maybe Mary herself did not have a sinful nature. And this is why Jesus didn't have a sinful nature. And this is where the entire idea of the Immaculate Conception came from. If you've ever heard of Immaculate Conception, oftentimes we think that's the conception of Jesus, and it's not. The Immaculate Conception is actually the idea that God miraculously prevented Mary herself from inheriting a sinful nature from her human parents. So God stepped in, he did this miracle, he prevented Mary from receiving the sinful nature, and this is how Jesus never received a sinful nature. And that's the whole doctrine of Immaculate Conception and how Mary is venerated as one without sin. Another area in Catholic theology this impacted was baptism. It became believed by Augustine and other church leaders at that time that when you're baptized in water, your sinful nature is miraculously transformed or cleansed or washed away. And there is some support for this in a few verses I think we're going to look at in the next message that Paul says about baptism and what happens at baptism, and we'll unpack that a little bit more. But it was believed that the actual act of baptism does something miraculous in a person. When a person is baptized, the sinful nature they inherited from their parents that they've had up until that time is miraculously washed away and cleansed and will no longer be the determiner of their future eternal destiny. But then the question came up, what happens if a child dies before they grow up and get baptized? If people get baptized when they become followers of Jesus, when they convert to Christianity, that's when they get baptized and their sins are washed away, their sinful nature is washed away. What happens if a child grows up and they haven't been baptized yet? And the thought was, well, they're going to die and go to hell at that time because their sinful nature is still their core identity. That's what they've inherited, and nothing about their core identity has been changed yet because they have not been baptized yet. And so this is when the church began to baptize infants. Even though infant baptism does not seem to be the practice in the New Testament, it was believed that if this is the way that the sinful nature has to be cleansed and erased from someone, then we need to baptize infants even before they know it. Even before they can mentally believe or understand who God is or what Jesus has done for them, we need to make sure they are cleansed of their sinful nature and identity, and it is erased. So in case something happens to them and they happen to die, they will not be judged by their sinful nature and identity. They have been baptized and washed clean of that. So baptism and the practice of infant baptism is, there's some other reasons, so I'm simplifying it here, but is in large part related to this entire idea of original sin that is passed on and that we all inherit from our parents. All right? Now, let's move forward because I want to focus on the stream of Christianity that many of us come from. Some of us come from the Catholic stream, but when we get to the Protestant Reformation, as I mentioned in the last message, you have figures like Luther and Calvin who took this idea of original sin even further, and they came up with what they called total depravity. Now, total depravity was mostly codified or articulated in writing and in actual doctrinal statements in a couple of ways. First, at what's called the Synod of Dort, which happened from 1618 to 1619. So the Reformation begins, you could say, in about 1517. That's when Luther nails his theses to the door, and then he leads the Reformation in Germany, and Calvin leads the Reformation, and there's Zwingli and some others that are leading it in other parts of Europe. So about 100 years after the Reformation begins, the next generation of leaders and theologians that are part of the Protestant Reformation come together at the Synod of Dort. There's questions about salvation and God and the gospel and sin. And they come together and make some key decisions. Dort, this all takes place in the Netherlands, in the Dutch Reformed sort of stream of the Protestant Reformation. And coming out of the Synod of Dort come what we now call, they didn't call it at that time, but what we now basically call the 5 points of Calvinism. And there were 5 key doctrines about predestination, about sin, about Christ's death on the cross, all of these things. But one of those key points of Calvinism or the Reformed faith that came out of that was this whole idea of total depravity. So that's one place where total depravity is really codified and written down and sort of there's language put to it. And then the other place I briefly mentioned in 1646 is the Westminster Confession of Faith. This is a huge doctrinal statement that comes out of England. There's a civil war going on in England, and there's questions about the Anglican Church and others that are trying to reform the church. And a group of theologians come together at Westminster Abbey, and they come up with a statement that everyone can agree on, and that's why it's called the Westminster Confession of Faith. And the Westminster Confession of Faith becomes really the most foundational document from that time on in many churches that are part of the what's called the Reformed tradition, or later, one part of the Reformed tradition will be the Presbyterian tradition. So if you grew up Presbyterian or in a Christian Reformed church or a Dutch Reformed church or anything like that, you have probably heard the Westminster Confession of Faith many times growing up. Now, much of what we say about this doctrine of total depravity and what I mentioned in the last message is part of a larger group of teachings that I've already mentioned called Calvinism. Calvinism finds its root, obviously, in John Calvin, one of the reformers, but it was after him, many of his followers, that took some of his ideas and they put more flesh on the bones. And they came up with a very systematic way of thinking about all of the things that Calvin and also Luther and others believed. And this very systematic approach became known as Calvinism. Now, this thinking, this system of thinking called Calvinism, obviously affected the Protestant branches of Presbyterianism, of the Reformed Church, Lutherans as well. Luther had some slightly different ideas, so there's some subtle differences, but if you grew up Lutheran, unless you really studied this, you wouldn't know the differences. The way Lutherans think about this is very similar. It's to the way Calvinists would think about this. Anglicans as well. But even if you grew up in the U.S. in a non-denominational church or a Baptist church, you were also greatly affected by this entire way of thinking. There might not have been as many specific mentions of Calvinism or Calvin, or you may have never heard the Westminster Confession of Faith because there's other, you know, creeds or statements that Baptists would have leaned into. And then non-denominational folks usually didn't cite creeds or statements of faith. But most leaders and churches in the Baptist stream and in the non-denominational stream were very much embraced and affected by the core tenets of Calvinism and certainly the core tenet of total depravity. Which means if you grew up in an evangelical church in the late 20th century, or maybe you're even younger, particularly in America, you were almost certainly exposed to and shaped by this idea of total depravity. There's a few groups, and I'll stop the history lesson here in just a second, but just to let you know, there are a few groups that are less shaped by it. The tradition called the Arminian or Wesleyan tradition, and this would be Wesleyan churches, Methodist churches, churches that are part of the holiness tradition, which would be like Nazarenes, or the Church of God in Christ, or some of the Church of God or Church of Christ traditions, and then Pentecostal traditions. And all of those have some of their roots in the Methodist tradition that goes back to John Wesley, and even a guy named Jacob Arminius. So these leaders in the 1700s and then the 1800s had their own way of thinking about sin, but they tended to focus more on human choice and human responsibility. And I'm greatly simplifying it, but it means you probably still heard a lot about sin in these traditions. There just wasn't as great a focus on you having this sinful nature that you were born with that you just can't help but change. There was a lot more of a focus on you can change, and you do have the power, and God wants to help you. And so there's a greater focus on human responsibility in these traditions. And I would also add to this, most African-American traditions have a much greater focus on human responsibility and human choice and are less rooted in sort of the Calvinistic stream or Calvinistic traditions of total depravity. Now, let's talk about, come back to this idea of total depravity, because as I've thought about it, I want to offer some broader problems, if you will, or issues that I would raise with the idea of total depravity. Now, again, I say this as someone who at one point fully embraced total depravity, and there is a part of me that is not ready to fully let go of it, right? There are aspects of the human condition of our world, of all the violence and problems in our world that make total sense with total depravity. It does seem like humans, no matter how good they try to be, continue to find ways to screw up, to sin, and that things just continue to get worse and worse, right? But as the Calvinist stream articulated total depravity and took it in directions that Augustine probably never would have gone, there are a few challenges I would raise with it. And these would be ones that I would offer to you to consider. The first is systematic. One of the big problems with the way total depravity is conceived in the Calvinistic system is that there is a desire to try to put together a system that explains all of the tensions in the Bible that the Bible never actually resolves itself or fully explains. For example, there are verses in Paul that tend to sound like we are totally depraved and we have inherited a nature and we cannot help but sin. Romans 7 is one of those passages. Now, there's some debates about what Romans 7 means, but on the face of it, when you read Romans 7, Paul seems to be a guy who is wrestling with or used to wrestle with not being able to do what he wants to do and only doing evil, even though he doesn't want to do it, right? So there's certainly those kind of verses, but as I shared in the message, there are all kinds of verses and stories and passages of Scripture that seem to suggest we have total free will and total free choice. And so there's a tension there. And there are really no places in the Bible where the writers say, well, here's a tension and let me resolve it. Let me give you a system that explains everything. That seemed to be what the reformers really wanted to do. They wanted to take all of these aspects of teaching in the Bible and come up with a system that explained everything. And that is a worthy cause. And as someone who is a former engineer, I am bent that way. I want a system that explains everything, that everything fits into nicely and neatly. And the older I get, the more I learn that life cannot be explained that way. Reality cannot be explained that way. The mystery of God cannot be explained that way. The depth and chaos of sin cannot be explained by a nice, neat system. And so that's where I think total depravity potentially makes a mistake. It creates this doctrine and this system that tries to explain everything, but it's resolving tensions that the Bible never really resolves. And that gets into this, the second problem. I think, and I was talking with a family after the sermon on Sunday, this past Sunday, and here's one of the things we came away with sort of agreeing together. It seems like the doctrine of total depravity comes entirely from Paul and entirely from Romans 5 through 7, which admittedly, if you read Romans 5 through 7, I can see where someone would come away thinking Paul believed firmly in a doctrine of total depravity. But it seems like what has taken place is that system of understanding sin as total depravity and that we inherit this sinful nature from our ancestors and going back to Adam is the conclusion that comes out of Romans 5 through 7 and then is used to explain everything else in the Bible, even if everything else in the Bible doesn't really fit that system or that explanation or that understanding. I would suggest, and I think a lot of biblical scholars would suggest, that a better way to approach this would be to let the rest of the Bible explain those few chapters or those few passages in Paul. In other words, if Paul is saying something that we haven't heard from any of the other biblical authors, then we need to let our interpretation of Paul be informed by all of the other biblical authors. I'm not saying we throw Paul out. I'm just saying it needs to be deeply informed by everything else we read in the Bible rather than taking a small section of Scripture, coming away with an explanation for that, and then letting that reshape or be read back into everything else in the Bible. All right? Now, as I said, the Bible doesn't link Adam's sin with our sin outside of Paul. It's important. Jesus never does that. Somebody asked me after the message on Sunday, seriously, like Jesus, I mean, surely Jesus talks about Adam. And I said, no, he literally never uses the word Adam. Okay? The Old Testament never links human sin, Israel's sin, everybody else's sin in the world with Adam's sin. So Paul links these things, and we have to be good about trying to understand what Paul is talking about. But the rest of the Bible rarely links these things. The rest of the Bible doesn't talk about or use the language of being born into sin. The rest of the Bible never says we have a sinful nature that we can't help but sin. In fact, here's a great example, and we didn't have time to talk about this in the last message, But think about the way even the story of Adam and Eve is told. We import our ideas that this story is about the great fall of humanity into sin into the story. But if you go back and reread the story, the word sin is never used in Genesis 1 through 3. It's not used until Cain. That's the first time something is actually called sin. The word fall is never used in Genesis 1 through 3 to describe what happens with Adam and Eve. These are ideas we get from Paul that we import back into the story. But if you go back and read the story, it's actually quite surprising how the story is told in Genesis and how hopeful it is. It's not discouraging. There is not this sense that one of the consequences of sin is that we now all inherit a sinful nature. That is nowhere in the original story. There is the threat that if Adam makes the wrong choice, it will lead to death. So there is that threat. And then when Adam and Eve make this choice, there is a curse that is pronounced. But the curse is all about from here on out, humans are going to have to work harder than they were going to have to. There's going to be hard labor. It's going to be pain and painful. In fact, I would even say if you go back and read Genesis 3 and the consequences that are described there, it's mostly wounding language. It's pain language. There's suffering language. There's loss language. There's nothing about sin or the fall or a depraved nature or a new sinful identity that everyone after Adam will have that will be passed along. There's really not even much about death as a consequence. The only mention of it after Adam and Eve disobey is that they will return to the ground like dust. So that's sort of an implicit mention of death. But get this, immediately after that is said, immediately after it is said that one of the consequences is that Adam, from dust you came and to dust you will return. Next verse, this is Genesis 3, chapter 20. Adam named his wife Eve because she would become the mother of all the living. The word Eve in Hebrew means life. So if the curse of sin and the fall, which isn't mentioned in the story, is death, Adam doesn't get the memo, and the story doesn't get the memo, because the very next verse says, this woman will be named life because life will come from her. And then in the very next chapter, chapter four, starts the next story is Adam made love to his wife, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Cain. This is a very positive view of life and their life after the fall. No mention of death at this point. Now, the next story is she has Cain and then she has Abel. And then Cain gets angry at Abel because of their offerings that are offered. And God seems to accept one, but not the other. And it's at this point that God says to Cain, be careful here. Your anger's about to turn into something. God says, sin is crouching at the door, which seems to indicate Cain hasn't sinned yet, but he's about to. You have a choice, Cain. What you're angry about right now is about to turn into sin. You're about to do something you regret. Be careful. You have a desire right now, and if you let your desire overtake you and master you, then you will sin. Don't let this happen. You must rule over this desire, God says. But Cain doesn't. He has a choice, and he makes the choice to turn into action, to do violence against his brother. Now, no side comment is given at this point. You would think, if Cain has a sinful identity, you would think that the writer of Genesis would offer a side comment. By the way, When Adam made love to his wife, Eve, and they had a son, what was passed along to them genetically was the sinful identity. And just so you know, the reason that Cain couldn't master his desires in this moment, the reason that he ended up doing violence against his brother is because he couldn't help it, because he inherited a sinful identity from Adam and Eve, who started the whole thing off. But that's not in there anywhere. The story of Adam and Eve and Cain and the rest of Israel for the rest of the Old Testament is the story of choice. The story that they can choose to do the right thing if they want, but they don't. And no writer in all of the Old Testament ever stops to say, you know, the reason they couldn't make the wrong choice is because they had a sinful identity. They just kept inheriting over and over and over and over. So this is where we really have to be careful, because we have often read back into all of these stories or read back into Jesus a few things that Paul says. And again, I'm not saying we need to throw Paul out. We have to understand him. We have to weigh what he says accurately and well. But we need to not let it shape how we view everything else. Another thought I've had over the last few days is I've thought about this doctrine of total depravity that is so prominent in the Reformed and the American evangelical tradition. I think it's based on a premise, and I'm totally thinking out loud here, so I could be entirely wrong. You could see something different here, but I've wondered if it's based on a premise. And that we need to test the premise or the assumption. Because it's this idea, total depravity, that God is disgusted with us. He is displeased with us. We are so sinful and so totally depraved, and it just is disgusting to God. I wonder if there is an underlying assumption that the more horrible we are, the greater God's grace and love must be. Do you understand? This is a good intention, right? By some well-meaning followers of Jesus to magnify and exalt God's grace and love. And the idea is God loves us and God is showing grace to us. And the worse we are, the more horrible we are, the more great his love and grace must be. The assumption is the more undeserving we are, the greater the act of grace is. The grace is greater if the recipient of that grace is even more undeserving. Love is greater if the recipient of that love is even more disgusting. And I wonder if that's actually true. I don't know. It's more of a philosophical question, but I was thinking, is the parent who loves a very rebellious child more loving than the parent who loves a more obedient child? Can we really compare two different parents in that way and look at one parent who has a child who's very rebellious and they keep loving this parent, this child? And then there's another parent who has a child who's mostly obedient and that parent loves their child. Can we really say that the first parent is more loving than the second parent? Or consider, and again, I'm just kind of grasping for examples of love here. Consider two spouses. One spouse loves their spouse who has committed adultery. Is that first spouse more loving than a different example of a couple who love each other and they never committed adultery? If you have a faithful spouse that's faithful to you your entire life and you continue to love them, is your love somehow less good or less loving than the example of someone else who has a spouse who's committed adultery and been unfaithful, but they keep loving them? I mean, certainly it shines a light on the love if you love someone who has hurt you or wounded you. Certainly, it shines the light on a parent's love if they love their child, even if their child continues to be rebellious. But is it really greater than a different parent or a different spouse? I just don't know. I think we need to test this idea that love or forgiveness or grace is greater if God is first disgusted or displeased with us. I'm not sure that's true. And if it's not true, then it means it has led to a horrible misunderstanding of who God is. If I have to be so disgusted in his sight in order to truly understand his love. And I think that's one of the biggest problems with this idea of total depravity. It destroys our self-identity. It makes us hate ourselves. And in some ways, it makes us enslaved to the guilt and the shame we must continually feel about ourselves if we're truly to understand God's love and grace. And this is where I think seeing sin differently and understanding sin as wounding can really help. It explains our story as wounded and hurt creatures who have inherited a story and have inherited wounds that are real and that have had profound effect in our lives. Augustine was right about that. We do inherit something and it shapes us. But wounds do not change our core identity. Now, how would an understanding of sin as wounding explain Adam's fall or Adam's sin? We didn't get into that, and it's fascinating because there is a church father, one of the original church theologians who lived a couple hundred years before Augustine and Pelagius ever did. His name was Irenaeus. He lived in the second century. Tradition says that he received his teaching from a guy named Polycarp. He was actually sort of trained in the faith and ordained to be a leader in the church by this guy named Polycarp. And Polycarp was taught by the Apostle John himself. So Irenaeus can trace his sort of understanding of what it means to follow Jesus and his understanding of doctrine and faith all the way back to the Apostle John. And Irenaeus was one of the first ones to describe Adam's sin. And he described it in this way. He described it as the old wound of the serpent. He says that people can be saved from sin. People can be saved in no other way from the wound that they received, the old wound of the serpent. That's how Irenaeus understood original sin. It was a wound inflicted upon Adam by the serpent. That there was the serpent, and again, he's probably taking the story literally. There was the serpent in the garden, and the serpent lied to Adam and Eve. The serpent deceived them. The serpent led them to believe that God couldn't be totally distrusted and that what God said wasn't really true or it was half true. The serpent wounded Adam and Eve, and the result of that wounding was loss of trust, it was deep pain, it was loss, it was shame, it was blame, it was them pointing the finger at each other, it was more wounding. So what better way to maybe describe original sin than original wounding? This original sense of loss that Adam and Eve experienced that just continues to lead to more loss and more pain and more shame. And we inherit these losses and we inherit these stories and we inherit these wounds from our early lives. Now, I realize that does not provide a systematic understanding of exactly what Paul is trying to say in Romans 5 or another place that he teaches about this in 1 Corinthians 15. But this is where I think it's important for us to hold all of these metaphors together. Yes, sin can be disobedience. It can be breaking a rule or a law, and that's important. But it's also important to see sin as wounding and loss and the pain and the harm that we experience when we harm ourselves and when we harm one another. And it's a much more complex and multifaceted and mysterious understanding of this thing called sin that I'm not sure is ever going to be fully understandable by our minds. All right, let me offer one other thought. And as I said, these are not necessarily sequential thoughts. This is just throwing a lot at you to think about. But I want to close this podcast with one interesting story that I think could highlight the nature of sin as wounding and the way God loves us. And it's probably the most famous story that Jesus ever told. It's the story of the prodigal son. Now remember the context. Jesus is teaching one day, and he's not just teaching, he's hanging out with a bunch of questionable people, people that have very sinful reputations. And it's in fact the religious leaders that are challenging Jesus about this. Why do you hang out with people who are sinners? And Jesus responds by telling three stories. So the three stories he tells are in response to questions about sin and sinners. All right? That's important. He tells these stories to clarify his understanding, or we might better say God's understanding towards sin and sinners. Why is Jesus hanging out with people who are disgusting? That's basically what the religious leaders are saying. These people are prostitutes. They're tax collectors. They're like the lowest of low. Why would you hang out with them? So Jesus is explaining why he would actually like and want to be with and not find unpleasing the people that all the religious leaders find unpleasing and disgusting. So that's the context. He tells three stories. First story is about a sheep that's lost. There's 100 sheep, but one sheep is lost. Second story is about a coin that's lost. And then the third story, as we all know, is about the son who's lost. And if you know the story well, you know it's not just about one son. There's actually a second son. And the second son is just as lost as the first son. But the focus of most of the story is on the first son. Now we get to this third story, and here's an interesting question to ask. You remember the son comes to the father and he says, give me my inheritance. I want to take it and go live my own life. And the father gives it to him. And it's kind of like saying, let's pretend you're dead, dad. I want to go live apart from you. I want the inheritance I would receive if you died. Give it to me. So here's the question. What is the sin that this son is committing against his father? Is he breaking a rule? Is he disobeying his father? Not really. I mean, sin as disobedience is a helpful category, but it doesn't apply in this story. There really is no rule or law the son is breaking. He's not disobeying. The father has not commanded him to do something that he is not doing. The father doesn't say, no, you cannot have your inheritance. And if the father said that and the son then stole the money, we might call this disobedience or breaking a law, but it's not. He asks his father for the money and the father actually gives it to him and lets him go. It's not disobedience. Is it idolatry? Not really. Certainly not in the standard way. Now we talked about Augustine. His understanding of idolatry was disordered loves, and that might help here. Perhaps the son is falling in love with his desire for independence and autonomy, maybe wealth, maybe to experience all that life has to offer. Maybe he's in it for the adrenaline kick of doing things he's never been allowed to do because it says he's later he takes all the money and he squanders it on wild living. So maybe there are some things that he was not supposed to do or always forbidden to do, and he wanted to go try those things instead of living under the protection and the life that his father has created for him. So maybe there is a disordered love there, but you know, idolatry isn't a great explanation for the sin that the son is committing against the father. You know what the son is doing? He is wounding the father. That's the best way to understand this. He is relationally disconnecting and abandoning his father. He is pulling away from the relationship and saying, I don't want to live with you anymore. I don't want to live under your leadership anymore. I want to do my own thing. Even though I am not ready to do it, I don't want to be connected to you anymore. And any parent of any child would tell you that would be a deep wound for a son or daughter to ever say, I don't want to have anything to do with you anymore. Wounding is probably the best way to understand what's going on here. You might even say the same thing about the older brother at the end of the story. The older brother is saying, I've done everything. Why would you ever receive this son back who's been so horrible? The older brother is wounding the father. It's like the older brother doesn't understand the love of the father. The older brother is saying, I deserve more. I deserve better. Even though the father's saying, I've given you everything. This is a wound as well that the older brother is inflicting upon the father. See, wounding, I think, is the best explanation of the sin that is described in this story. But here's another question. What is the father's response when the son, the first son, so deeply wounds him? Is the father disgusted by the son? Does the father now declare to everyone in the village, my son has offended me? He has offended my honor. He has offended this entire family and this entire village, and he is now our enemy. Is the son thoroughly disgusting and displeasing to the father? Is the father waiting to punish the son for what he has done? The story that Jesus tells does not describe the father in any of these ways. It's clear when the son returns what the emotional disposition and attitude of the father is. He never stops loving the son. He never stops hoping for the son. In fact, nothing has changed about who the son is. If anything, perhaps his compassion and pity has grown for the son. The son has wounded the father, but the father knows the son has also wounded himself. He's wounded the family. The son is going to receive and experience pain and suffering himself because of these decisions that he has made. There is wounding to go around all everybody's lives in what the son has done, but the father's love never changes toward the son who has wounded him. I think Luke 15 needs to shape our understanding of sin, our understanding of identity, and our understanding of God and his disposition towards us and what it means that God actually loves us. See, whenever I read Paul, I want to take seriously what Paul says about sin and wrath. And Paul talks about wrath. We can't throw that away. But it needs to be shaped by the stories that Jesus told, particularly when Jesus was challenged to say, what do you believe about sin, Jesus? What do you believe about love, Jesus? What do you believe about God, Jesus? Jesus says, here's what I believe. If you want to know what God is like and what sin is like and why I'm hanging out with sinners. Here's why. We need to let stories like these shape how we understand Paul, not the other way around. That's a lot to think about. I hope you'll stick with us in this series on sin. There is more to be said because Paul has more metaphors to give. And so we will unpack those as we go forward. I hope this is helpful. Thank you for listening as always.